money. And a special welcome to the Deputy Minister. Deputy Minister, I see from our minutes that the last time we had this meeting, you were with us leading the delegation. Thank you very much for joining the entire meeting. But I see the delegation is a little bit into the familiar faces. I don't see, but I know that sometimes the same size does not count. I don't know, the information is there. I know that it's for members, it's kind of a Monday today. The members are able to travel the night before, in the morning. But we have to start. Deputy Minister. The purpose of this meeting is really again to say how much progress have we made since we last met. We last met in February, if I'm correct. I think we last met in February, where we had some discussions and some certain agreements that we reached on terms of the way forward. And I see that there's also been all kinds of pressure from your stakeholders who want the department to do this and that. Sometimes, if I can criticize you, GM and the department, sometimes I haven't had the feeling that you were coming out clearly on some of the things that I think that they are there, you know. On this issues of people talk about the norms and standards or all those kind of things and, about the progress that has been made. I don't think that we have really been able to communicate the progress that we have made up so far. This program was adopted in 2011, and I think that a lot of progress has been made to change the schools around the inappropriate structures that the department calls them. Maybe there have not been enough pace, maybe we have not had enough pace to ensure that there was progress, but I think that the progress that is being made, but also, I don't know, but you know, this committee at the end, it was kind of turned into a committee of education and infrastructure because of the special attention that the committee has paid in ensuring that there was progress on this program. You know, now I see when the schools are opened, Mr. Radiati, honestly, it's in the press, the media, that you'll be opening schools there. I'm sure the committee would feel honored one day to be honorable sir, to be invited in one of the schools that you visited. You know, and in the program, you know how long we have been traveling there, that we are sure that that new school. But also, I don't know how much recognition was given to communities to build those mass schools, you know, when there was no alternative. And communities took it upon themselves to ensure that their children had what they call opportunity of education available to their kids. You know, I remember we went to a school, and that school, I think for the past year, we have requested a list of the schools that are going to be built there. I still want to see that school in that list. The name of the school was Makam Sholo. I'm sure the honorable members would remember who had been there, who have been there. We went to that school, Makam Sholo. It is in what area is that? Fort St. John's, eh? Yes, I think it was in Fort St. John's, you know. It was one of those areas, you know, where the parents were there ensuring that there was schooling in their communities. And so I think that we really, maybe when we criticize and do what, but I think that we should really be able to recognize the work that the communities have done to just ensure that there was education. You know, when we went to that school at the end, the parents were saying that every year, in fact, there was a lot of frustration in the area because the district directors, they were saying, no, every year we are asked to prioritize, to make priorities, and this school has been one of our priorities. Anybody will correct me if I'm wrong. And this school has been one of the priorities. But they were told that we are told that it's going to be built next year, next year, next year. So that's why I think as a committee, as a legacy of Mashiro, if we could just have the school in the list, that we know that is one of the priority schools. But we do know, we are aware on everything, that some schools perhaps maybe too small to form a school on their own. But there are challenges of distances in those areas. So that if then this one can be changed, what is it that is going to be done about the schools? We have visited some schools in terms of looking at infrastructure, general about the issues of sanitation and electricity. Went to a certain school, you know, where Honorable Ashagana, I can't forget the mayor, what the mayor said. He was asking me one day, why Chairperson, did you keep quiet when this mayor confronted us? So we go to the school, it's high school. Is it Nyanga? But over Manzana High School. We go there. There's no sanitation. You know, the toilets are full and everything. So, and when we go to the meeting now, after having inspected the premises, the mayor comes and says to us, look, this school is one of the best in terms of the standard here. And you're coming to criticize it because you don't know what is the situation around. So we are saying we really appreciate the program that are there on sanitation and electrification of the school. However, when the resources are made available, I think it is the responsibility of this committee to ensure that those resources are utilized. We have been able also to learn that the challenge with this program has been the progress. I think that it has been at a snail's pace. You know, I was looking just closing over the presentation, the one thing is provided that given the schools, it takes a year just to appoint your professional, what you call it, it takes a year, just a year to sign them off. It takes another year to go to the next, what you call the program. So obviously we're going to understand if we do that. Because every year there's a we vote for a budget. Every year there's a budget that is voted. But that budget assumes that there's going to be actual construction that's going to take place. But if planning, now I'm just talking about appointing professionals, it takes a year for professionals to appoint contractors, it takes another year, to put up the, what you call now, to put the first brick on the school. That is where our challenge is. And I think that, we think that as a committee today, we must really together say, where is the problem? Let's identify this problem, and by the end of this meeting, we must resolve those are because the issue that make it difficult to fast track this process. And we think that it can. It's not that we don't have the people to implement on the ground, but it's not our system. They are too slow. You know, they don't talk to the agencies of the matter. Now, if there is a fair issue, it's business as usual, I think that we can't, what you call it, approach things like this. But on that note, Honorable Deputy Minister, I'm trying to welcome you and perhaps invite you to address us. Thank you. Is it okay if I do it from here, Comrade?
Well, I can take this opportunity of thanking the chairperson and your committee for the extraordinary support that you provided to the committee. I take the task of monitoring very, very seriously. And certainly as a result of this kind of oversight, I think we've seen the benefits that can be derived from this exercise in the sense that it applies pressure on the department to ensure that it does its work more efficiently. In a much more organized way. Chairperson, I have the benefit of being accompanied by a delegation on my extreme right. Mr. Rogier is the Acting Director General, Mr. Perry Padiachi, whom this committee is familiar with. He has represented the department on many occasions. Seated right next to me is Ms. Solo Diale. She has been really the pulse of the department in terms of its infrastructure program, and we're really grateful for her hard work. Seated behind me is Mr. Jan Breitenbach. Mr. Breitenbach, just stand up so that I could see you. And we've got Mr. Albert Gumbo and Mr. Cheney Ramtele, as well as Mr. Liu Mahada, and Tembi Matinda.
Oh, sorry. Thank you
very much. So that's the delegation, so it's not a small delegation exactly, it's reasonably big. But secondly, Chair, just to really say to you, I'm really disappointed that an invitation has not been extended to you and your committee for visiting the schools. We are already on a program which we've announced more than 5 weeks ago of delivering a school per week. And so far we have indeed been delivering more than a school per week, but we're saying a school per week. This week, Friday, for example, I will be going to Lode to deliver a school. And the week after, and the week after, and the week after, we will provide the portfolio committee with a schedule of schools. And in fact, I would personally address a letter to the chair as well as members of the committee to invite you each and every opening of the school. But in that context, Chair, we do so because we acknowledge the role that you've played. It's not really sitting here at your desk and saying, well, you know, you have challenges in relation to infrastructure. You've been physically to the bases over there, engaged with the communities, engaged with the stakeholders, engaged with the portfolio committee, and all these interactions have been robust. but legitimately so, and we don't take unkindly to it. In fact, we welcome this kind of intervention and the support that you provided. I just want to assure you, Jay, in the context of what you had raised, that your observations are very consistent with ours, and quite deliberately, if you look at what is being done in the Eastern Cape, the areas of focus have been Libote, Lusikisiki, and Lipotsenjoz areas in terms of where we started, because these are the most economically depressed areas which require urgent and immediate attention. So I just want to draw your attention to that. In the Libote district itself, in the course of this year, you would have no less than 12 schools that are going to deliver to that district alone. And so that's the one point. The other point, as you correctly indicated, is that as you deliver your schools, you must affirm and recognize the contribution of the community. We've ensured that this delivery doesn't just take place as a mechanical delivery. We set up a marquee, invite communities and stakeholders, ensure that the representatives of the community, not only the governing body, are present out there, so that the community takes ownership of this particular institution. So we want to give you an assurance that each and every one of the deliveries were accompanied by a very vibrant interaction with the community, and certainly an acknowledgement of the role that they have played in providing education in a very difficult and challenging environment. The will of the people basically had made that possible. So that acknowledgement is indeed taking place. I can say firsthand because I've been involved in the particular process. And what I can report back to you, Chairperson, and members of the honourable members of the committee, is that the excitement of the community and the parents is just unbelievable. To them, this is an island of hope and sea of misery, if I could put it that way. If you look at the abject poverty in and around the school, and this school now represents a symbol of progress for the community. So I certainly would endorse that particular sentiment. Beyond that, Chairperson, is I think we've all learned. I think your portfolio committee has learned, your standing committee, we've learned as a department and as a ministry. We've done some extraordinary things, and I would want to share with the members of the portfolio committee. It's very unusual for a minister of, deputy minister of basic education, deputy minister of finance, deputy minister of justice and constitutional development, with the DG, the engineers, the DDG, and engage with contractors in relation to the target end. So what we say is that what we hear from you is taken very, very seriously, and we basically said, we're not going to just sit out there at a distance and say, provide us with a report. We're going to get engaged in this particular process. But the things that we've learned as a result of our interaction and by overseeing what you are actually doing and what we do jointly is that we can't always assume that contractors who are regarded as credible contractors who have a record of delivery would always deliver on time. In terms of the 49 schools, for example, you would find a renowned, reputed contracting company having dealt with infrastructure programs to both the country, Ms. Armstrong, has been determined to have contracts simply because they were not able to perform. While on the other hand, small entrepreneurs who are able to deliver timely, school by school. So that's one reality that we have to face. So don't make assumptions that merely on the basis of reputation, your contractors would be able to deliver. The second assumption that we made, in fact, contractors made rather than ourselves, is that all things are equal. All things are not equal in terms of the geological and geographical conditions in different provinces. So we're building Gauteng, and when you build in the Eastern Cape, it's totally different in terms of the provision of material, in terms of transport, in terms of access, in terms of a range of things, including electricity and some things as basic as water, and also the procurement of appropriately skilled people to oversee projects. That's another reality that we certainly would not ignore. The third reality, Chairperson, I'm taking this committee into my absolute confidence because I don't think it's something that we've got to try to duck and avoid and evade. The reality is that even our institutions that supported us as agencies, whether it's IDT or whether it's DBSA, had challenges in terms of human capacity, in terms of dealing with the matter as agencies on behalf of the state. that if we were bolstering our capacity as a department, we found, and through this interaction, the BBSA had similar challenges, and so did IET. And given the reality, I mean, as I could share with you that as a lawyer, I've practiced law for about 18 years. Unfortunately, I knew what contracts are all about and how they should be developed and designed. I found serious limitations in terms of the legal contracts that were concluded at the time. Not by the department, but by BBSA on behalf of the department. And these reviews drew attention to this fact, and they realized that they have to reinforce those elements there. So many mistakes would have been made as a result, I don't think maliciously, but as a result of lack of capacity. And I think this has been an important learning curve. Where are we now? We can celebrate, Chairperson, and I'm putting this to the committee, and you can call me to say, why did you mislead me if it doesn't happen? We are delivering a school per week. But this is not a school. A school that's fully furnished, a school that has ICT connectivity, a school that has a human resource, I mean, a learner resource center, and a school, even if it's a primary school, that has a laboratory. It's quite unusual in the context of where we are. And I think that is something that we can celebrate. And I think you are absolutely, absolutely correct in saying that we've been very poor communicators in terms of our achievements. Because when we see visually, and quite sadly, obviously, that we see a picture of a mud school, which is certainly a violation of the dignity of our learners, we all lament and we all express our disappointment. But 3 months thereafter, it's replaced by a full-service, state-of-the-art school. No pictures are shown, no projection is made to say, this is where we were, and I think this is what you are saying. To say, how can we tell our people, inspire some hope, to tell them that today is better than yesterday. The changes are indeed taking place. It might have been a little long. We apologize for the delay, but this is the reality that we are coming, that we are seeing from time to time. And certainly, in this regard, I want to share with you that we are doing everything possible in terms of improving, and I think we have significantly in recent times, not a long time ago, in recent times, improved on that particular strategy of communicating much more efficiently and much better, but we take into account what you are raising, because it helps me tremendously, Chairperson, when you say it, so that when I speak to my officials in the department, including the acting DDA, I'll tell them it's not only my view, it is also the view of the portfolio committee in relation to this particular aspect. So I thought I'd raise that particular matter. Chairperson, then the concern that you've raised quite legitimately and understandably in relation to school in Port St. John's. It's a school that had 90 learners, and a decision had to be taken as to whether we should merge and rationalize in the context of the broader challenges that we face in the Eastern Cape so that we have an efficient institution that could provide best. But given the realities of distances that you spoke about and other surrounding circumstances, the department, the national department now, you can hold me responsible for it, has indeed identified the school as the site where any school is going to be built. So it features right now, as we speak, on the list of schools. And you can hold me responsible, yes. I am accountable. I am accountable because I did so on the basis that, now, unless between now and the time that we start building, the learner population drops to below 50. I cannot say. If it is not less than 90, the school will be built. So that's the reality of it. I'm not going to build a school. I certainly would not authorize it for 35 learners when there's such a huge demand countrywide, and that's the reality that we face. But all things being equal, and on the basis of where we are now in terms of the enrollment and the distances between that particular site and the schools that are available in the vicinity, we thought it would be most appropriate for purposes of accessibility, more particularly, to build a school. So, Chair, what we're saying to you is we are delivering one school per week, not only for this year, not only until elections, but beyond that. So you can say during this year and during next year, you will be having delivery of one school per week. That's important to note. We are endeavoring, and I'm saying now, please, don't think I'm making it a commitment. We are endeavoring to increase it to 2 schools a week next year. We are endeavoring, but the one school per week, and I've said it publicly, except for the festive period. So please don't come to me on Christmas week and say, you have not delivered. because nobody at work at that time, nobody would want to attend. Yeah. So during the festive period, there won't be any delivery of schools, but beyond that, before and thereafter, you would have a delivery of schools. And in fact, like I said, on Friday this week, I will be going down to Libore and delivering another school. And I look forward to the exercise because it really does inspire hope in our community. The question then arises, and what you have raised, is the result of this delay. Eastern Cape is quite different, and I think we must understand that. But when we look at the phenomenon of mud schools, we can say quite comfortably that we've eradicated it in the other provinces. And we have a phenomenon now in Eastern Cape. And sadly, that in the Eastern Cape, rather than become lesser, we discover new mud schools month by month, some in very deep remote areas. We basically took it upon ourselves to say, now we're going to rely on information that is provided to us by the province. We're going to make our own audit, and as a result of it, we discovered that there were more mud schools than were provided to us in terms of the data. But we've given priority to the Eastern Cape. Where are we now? We are, and you're going to get a detailed report here. I'm not going to assume the responsibility of the acting DG in terms of providing with the specific details, but to say to you that 201 schools have been identified for construction. 51, more than 50 schools, are already in construction. Now, I'm not talking about our 49 schools that we've spoken so much about earlier. I'm talking about our new schools. And I would imagine, and subject to correction now, that we are between 25 and 30% on average in relation to the construction of those 50 additional schools. That's 50 plus schools. It might be 51. And that we hope to accelerate what you are saying, the delivery on site, in order to get the people into on site, basically commence with the other schools. We have chosen 50 schools in the Eastern Cape, there's 50 schools in the Western Cape, there's schools in the Free State, one in the Northwest, and one in other parts of the provinces. And those are mainly unsafe schools in the other provinces. But in the Eastern Cape, it's really the phenomenon of mud schools more than anything else that we have to deal with. So they will be the beneficiaries. And this information and data would be provided to you by the acting DG when he makes his presentation. But again, as I said, we should reflect, and as we listen very carefully to what you raise, Chairperson, and you yourself and members of your committee. And in fact, quite interesting, the President asked the same question. To say, if you have such a backlog in the Eastern Cape in particular, and you are not able to build simultaneously, in other words, you are unable to build 300 schools, say, for example, what do you do in the interim in order to ensure that we do not violate the dignity of those learners, whether it's in terms of sanitation, whether it's in terms of a safe classroom? And the suggestion is that we would provide interim structures immediately to deal with that. So if you're going to be building after 18 months, you could have mobile classrooms and mobile facilities in the meantime, so that those children there are not challenged in terms of, some of the conditions are so appalling that nobody can defend it, you know. So we recognize that, and that's a commitment that we've given to our president, and indeed the department is working on mobile classrooms for those structures that are not going to be commenced with immediately, so that we have a situation where at least there is a measure of redress. And it's not a permanent measure, it's a temporary measure until the permanent structures are built. Now, Chairperson, let me conclude by dealing with one issue that you've raised, and it is in the public domain. I think, if we had communicated better, we would have probably won the war, if it were, in relation to what is happening. The reality about norms and standards is as follows, and I don't want to share this with the committee, I'm not going to be very long on it. In 2008, in the previous administration, there were norms that were developed by the former Minister of Education at the time, Naledi Pandor. Now, these norms were not regulated or prescribed. They were published for public comment. A new administration came into being, and these norms were then submitted to the Council of Education Ministers, called the CEM. MECs raised concern about the fact that the norms were too optimal, and they were inflexible. That there were serious nuances and asymmetries in terms of development. So when you go to the Eastern Cape and you compare it to Gauteng or the Western Cape, you're talking about two different provinces in terms of its outlay, in terms of its needs and its demands, and so forth. And it might be counterproductive to have optimal norms which are rigid. To give you an example, more than 25% of our schools chairperson are multi-grade schools. Now, these schools, as you would well know, are schools of about one or two classes because they serve such a small size learner population. Under norm state, for example, you're going to provide a computer lab or a computer room resources. Now, in a school of about 35 or 40 learners, multi-grade, it might be better to give each learner a tablet than providing a computer lab because it's going to cost us too much and it will be much more efficient. And basically, this is some example of the kind of flexibility that you require. Do you require a laboratory for 35 learners in primary school? No. So these are considerations. And what they said that we should basically adopt the norms that have been produced as a guideline. And everybody accepted it, and it was adopted as a guideline. However, the equal education was not happy with that particular situation, and they demanded that these norms be proclaimed as norms that are binding. And again, we said, fine, we reached an agreement to say that we would develop norms, but there would be a measure of flexibility in it. And we did indeed proclaim, give our gazette, and publish those norms. The concern was raised again. As a result of the publication, we received various submissions. Among these submissions came from Equal Education, some came from Departments of Education, others came from NADLAC itself. NADLAC had provided us with an interim report and wanted us to wait for a final report. Now we were juxtaposed between proclaiming those norms, and the easiest way would have been to what we had presented, we could proclaim. That would be very, very easy, but I don't think you would have that expectation. You as a chairperson who is engaged in oversight would want to say, look, please apply your mind to the submissions that you receive, as you do as a committee, and then determine whether you should refine your norms and improve it. And there were some substantive suggestions that were made, and we engaged with them and told them, listen, this is what we've received, and as a result thereof, we cannot possibly take into account all the submissions and prescribe in time. We need an extension of time. They determined, in their own wisdom, I don't know if that's right, maybe the legal advice, is that now that was not necessary and they're going to take us to court. So as they were talking with us, they were already in the street and they went to court at the same time. We met with them and we told them there are three voices that you have. I'll take things into the perspective, you know, so that we shared these ideas and the MEDs were present at the time. We said the three possibilities you have are the following. One is that the minimum norms that we had published in time, we will publish again. So that we do so just in terms of compliance, please not tomorrow they suggest to us that we have not applied our minds to the submissions that we've received. The second alternative is obviously for you to take into consideration what we are raising and agree to an extension of time. And the third is to contest it in court. Within less than half an hour, they came back and they said, oh, they accept our proposal and indeed we are entitled to the exception. The question then is, why would they want to go to court? The impression that has been created in the psyche of our people has been a conflation of poor governance and the production of norms and standards. We have the difficulty in the Eastern Cape, not because of norms and standards, but because of a lack of governance. That's why we have intervened. That is why the National Department is taking over that responsibility. And that is the reality. Why is the phenomenon of mud schools not existing anywhere else? And the reality is that notwithstanding the fact that as we speak right now, there are no norms and standards that have been proclaimed, but we are delivering a school per day. The third reality, Chairperson, is that at no single occasion in the course of the past 10 years has anybody come to the department and said that this structure that you built, whether it's in the Eastern Cape, the Popo, or Gauteng, does not comply to minimum standards. What they spoke about were these dilapidated, run-down mud schools that we're trying to substitute because they are not habitable, they violate the dignity of the learner, and we do not disagree, we agree that they make no sense. Nobody can defend a lack of sanitation that you speak about. But if we do that, we must be mindful. In 1996, Chairperson, 9,000 schools were without water. Right now, it's just a little more than 1,000, I think 1,124, if I'm not mistaken. So we have made progress between 1996 and now in terms of the elimination. Now, it is not acceptable that we even have one school without water or sanitation. But progress has made, and again, what you are saying, have we been able to communicate this to our people, to say to them, look, this is where we were 5 years, 10 years ago, this is where we were 5 years ago, this is where we are now. I don't think we've done extremely well in this regard, and we apologize for it, because we then create a negative sentiment in the minds of people who believe that nothing has indeed changed. And I think that's the reality that we have to look at. And therefore, in terms of our identification, we have 1,120 schools without water, 741 without sanitation, and 916 without electricity. And if you look at where we are, I think we've done reasonably well, notwithstanding the delays. And I think if we work hard enough, Chairperson, within the next 2 years, that would be a phenomenon of yesteryear. I think that is what I would like to say to you. So I hope I have assisted in clarifying the position with regard to the norm. As we speak right now, we have agreed that we will proclaim the norms by the end of November. We would basically accept them in sometime in September, I think mid-September, and proclaim them by the end of November. We have worked extremely hard at the draft, and obviously we would have to engage with the MECs of the nine provinces and other stakeholders. And we thought that even though there is no requirement in law or in terms of the agreement to consult with them, we thought that stakeholders who have basically shown an interest, who have made suggestions, should be consulted with, because that is part of the process of our democracy, which we regard and respect. And we do hope that this would be a matter of the past. We want to warn and caution the chair and this committee. There are other interest groups that are at work. Irrespective of what we're going to publish, it is going to be challenged. And again, you're going to see not in the school, but a photograph of an old dilapidated school. And they're going to say, look, this is what the norms are saying. Shouldn't the norm say more than that? Isn't this community entitled to better than that? What about the sports field? So if you don't have land with a sports field, and you provide a sports field, why is it for only one code? Why is there not more than one code that is provided for? So when you provide a lab, then they're going to ask you about the computers. And when you provide computer lab, they're going to ask you about the tablets. So I'm saying to you that, you know, what is the context and what is the reasonable provision of services? We are saying that we must do our best, that we must connect to our schools. It's important and critical to do so. But the minimal things is basically a safe environment, peripheral fencing, laboratory, learner resource center, and connectivity. That becomes very critical in the 21st century, and that's the kind of environment we're trying to provide. So I'm sorry for being so long, Chairperson, but really I am going to, today I'm not going to run away. The last time, remember, I had to come and I had to go to another engagement and another meeting, and I received your apology. I will stay for the duration of this meeting. And with your permission, Chairperson, I will then invite Mr. Peri Padiachi to make the detailed presentation on behalf of the department. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning to you, Honorable Members. Thank you to the Minister. I think some of the points raised by the Honorable Chair regarding communication, Mr. Gombo, who's sitting behind me, is on the project supporting unit with communication special. We have tried to address some of the issues that have been raised, and I think the start of the presentation, I just want to show you, if we've been brought in to assist us in dealing with some of the areas together with the department's communication team. And if you go to our department's website, you'll see the dedicated page as to the progress regarding infrastructure, as well as some narratives that have been produced, as well as when we go into this presentation, we're going to kick off with a DG regarding some of the things we've worked. We're not there yet in addressing the issue of communicating correctly with our citizens.
The black people of South Africa were denied access to education by the apartheid regime, especially in the rural areas. In a determined effort to afford their children an education, the local communities built schools using resources at their disposal. The black schools were a noble and proud attempt by disenfranchised people to determine their future.
This school was in 1985. The founder, Yako, the Kalela Ebenet Awa, wangekhovi nibafundisela ze urhulumente wathi masiye oosomashishini siele bafake igxalaba ukuze sibe siyakha isikolo sabe siyaqhaliswa ke iiclassroom ezintathu zodaka zenkulu kakhulu inxaxheba yabazali apha kuba baphile amagumbi amabini seyuka sade lofika ku-grade 9 isikolo abazali ke bemane besiza neenkxabi zabo kusahliwe zindlu zodaka abazali besobona bebefuqa ifani ezibhokothini zabo ukuncedisa oku kuba befuna imfundo kubantwana babo.
Today, fortunately, South Africa is a democratic society in a modern economy. In 2009, the Department of Basic Education submitted bids for a project to replace mud schools and other schools built from inappropriate material. Once approval had been granted by National Treasury in 2010, the Accelerated Schools Infrastructure Delivery Initiative was born. A period of program planning led by both environment professionals followed before the rollout could begin. To date, ASIDI has delivered 22 schools to the Eastern Cape, where the bulk of the challenge is, and counting. It is important to note that a city is not only about building schools. The apartheid regime denied about 1,000 schools access to water, electricity, and proper sanitation facilities. The program has met a 2011-2012 target in this regard, although they are delayed with the electrification project. Indeed, for school building program, it has not been smooth sailing. This is largely due to liquidation of subcontractors, poor performance by others, inclement weather, and the poor road terrain in the Eastern Cape.
We are very hard to have this school, and we are very thankful for the Nazi government of the Nazi at Kongole, at Nige, Skolo, at Kumkamato, with all the resources.
We are very hard to have this school, and we are very hard to
the FCD program is above all about restoring dignity to education and affording South African children the opportunity for a better future than that of their parents. ASIDI is delivering.
Thank you, Chair. Basically, like one of the visual materials that we are producing, but just going to the presentation. Basically, some background. This was our master list that we started off with, and then we had planned to roll them out over the multi-year for each of inappropriate electricity, sanitation, and water. And that, from the master list, after verification and assessment, it was found that in some areas, some of the schools have been dealt with, so therefore the numbers for water sanitation in some means decreased. And moving into the progress of a city, in addition to the 49, we had targeted 100, but through the PICC, we were requested to add another 102, which basically then ended up being 202 schools, which at presently we have 251. We do want to apologize in your copy, it says 252. The bulk of these are in the Eastern Cape, the DBSA with 99, and then we have the IDT Kuka and Public Works Eastern Cape. We've given another 30 schools to the IDT in Eastern Cape to look at alternative construction technologies, and the PICC is looking at that going forward. On average, we try to do 100 schools using alternative technologies. Then we have the schools that are spread across the remaining provinces. And just to go into the detailed progress, in terms of 49 schools, we had an average progress of 91.6%. You have heard in the DVD, we had 22 schools completed at the time we were making the DVD, but now we have 27 schools which have been handed over. The remaining schools are at various stages of completion. And the Deputy Minister highlighted some of the reasons in February, March, when 26 of these schools, 5 contracts had to be determined with one of the contractors going into liquidation. So we have 37 schools that have actually been, in practical completion, been handed over to us, which then becomes part of the program to hand over one school per week. And then in going forward beyond the 49, DBSA has 55 of those schools in the Eastern Cape and in Mpumalanga. They are still, in terms of the process, appointing professional service providers and in planning mode. With Public Works Eastern Cape, of the 16 schools, 10 are already in construction, and are others at various stages of planning, from handing over to contractors to finalizing assessments. With regard to IDT's 12 schools, 8 are with the contractors, and you can see that it's at about 37% progress, and the remaining 4 schools at various stages of planning in that regard. In this, with IDT, 425 jobs have been created to date, of which 218 are youth and 107 are for women. IDT Eastern Cape, as I indicated, we've given the 30 schools to look at using ACT. Kuka had 25 schools, 21 of them are in construction, and at 30% progress. They've created employment of about 943 jobs with 31 interns. In the Free State, IDT had 10 other schools. They were appointed last year. We've had issues dealing with the decanting of the schools and in sick of these schools, and their costs were over 66 million, even more than the cost of building these schools. And we've just finalized that by making them get new tenders, which has reduced the cost of decanting to half the price of what they were asking, to 31 million. So they've awarded the tenders for 9 of those schools. And these are these 9 schools with the IDT in the Free State, and you can see that the majority of them have come in under the estimates that the DDA had made in terms of costing. In fact, all 9. In the Free State, the other schools, DBSA with the 10, and the Free State Education Department as the other 10. They are still in the planning stage, and as indicated, the slow process in appointing has been a frustrating issue. DBSA has schools in the Mpopo as well as Northwest and Northern Cape, but they are like 3, 2, and 1 each. The Deputy Minister has highlighted the issue of the opening of the one school. Not just, we are presently handing over the ones that are being completed by the CD. There were 60 others that were completed by provincial departments. But in moving to this slide and to the meeting between the minister, deputy minister, and the president a while back, in which there were 261 schools that would be completed in the 4 years, but the issue being raised, how long would our learners have to wait for their dignity to be restored? And then the issue of providing mobile classes was raised by the president, that a plan should be prepared to deal with this. The department is busy working on this, and the plan is to provide mobile classrooms as well as mobile evolution blocks, not only in the Eastern Cape, but also in other provinces, and we think with the exception of Gauteng and Western Cape, unless they come forward and show us a case. So the other provinces are also being considered, and in completion of these inappropriate structures, we'll actually bring forward the schedule that's in terms of providing the temporary structures, but the billing program would continue if it took 2 to 3 years. And not to contradict the Deputy Minister on the example of the Port St. John School, what would happen is that irrespective of the discussions with the mergers and rationalization, we would provide these mobile structures because these learners would be utilizing those inappropriate structures. Once the decisions have been made to either build a school or relocate, then that would follow the CD building program. But the 261 schools that are there, which have been already part of the discussion for mergers and rationalization, we would then address them to this emergency measure to deal with the mobile classroom. In providing these mobiles, we'll also ensure that we'll address the issue of school furniture in these schools that are identified, and the plan is to look at dealing with this by December and January. The other risk obviously involved in that we need to look at the funding issues, and I think the major one would be is whether the manufacturers of the mobiles are able to supply us on time, in being able to put them on the site. And once these we start the building program and these mobiles are not needed, we could utilize them in other areas of the sector or within government. We're in discussions with National Treasury to look at how we deal with the procurement as well as the funding, and there are some options being considered, but these are the only two, to look at the education infrastructure done, and to look at, depending on how the spending is occurring, excluding Western Cape and Gauteng, to look at utilizing about 10% of those allocations. And even within the school's backup grant, which is a CD, we should look at, in terms of after analyzing but where we are, a portion of that could be utilized to fund the mobile classrooms. With regard to water and sanitation, basically in, we've completed, our, if you look at the bottom line, we've completed 166 of the projects that we had put out. 782 of these have been handed out now to the implementing agents to implement. And we have done 991 schools that basically received sanitation. We've got 441 from that, from the master list. The master list is not closed. As the minister had indicated, that with school identified, we then do an assessment and we look at to include them if they met the criteria, or we then look at placing them within the provincial program, even if it's done at the national level. The Bula Trust is an implementing agent for water and sanitation in the Eastern Cape. I wouldn't go through this. This slide basically gives the details of the project completed with sanitation and water. And then various stages of appointment in terms of assessment, and some have been handed out, they're procuring contractors for water and sanitation as well. And these projects we're looking at that before the end of the financial year, we should have the majority of them completed. IDT and CSIR is also dealing with water and sanitation in the Eastern Cape Department. And CSIR was appointed in December 2012, and they're covering, we're covering more than the districts that are linked to the inappropriate schools. In Limpopo, we have Mbula Trust managing the project. Their 78 projects were completed in 2011. We have 114 already in the process of being implemented. In KZN, we had 27 projects being completed. We're in the process of getting the completion certificate. IDT also has 89 projects in KZN. And we have provincial departments who are also implementing agents. And in the Free State, there the Free State Education was implementing 37 water and 36 sanitation at the farm pool. These are likely to be under 500,000, so they would probably use the quotation system. Northern Cape is an implementing agent with 9 water and 17 sanitation projects, and they've also brought on board IDT to assist them. In Northwest, there's 12, and IDT is also dealing with some of those projects. Gauteng, basically the water and sanitation has been dealt with. The 7 projects they had, they completed in March. They're now looking at issues where they're looking at upgrading some of the schools which already have some sanitation. With electrification, we completed 145 of the 159 that we are targeting, and there's 369 that has to be completed. With the budget, we have 2.4 billion in coming in this present current year, of which the 533 million to the Western Cape is actually a Schedule 4, but in terms of the Schedule 7 grant, then we have approximately 1.9 billion. We've actually transferred the tranche payment that we made to the various implementing agents is 1.5 billion. And overall, in the CD, the commitments are over 5 billion. We spent 170 billion in terms of expenditure for the current financial year. In 2013, the allocation was 2.0 billion, and we had spent 741 million. And a rollover had been requested for 1.3 billion. So the allocation, as I indicated, is a 2.4 billion, including the Schedule 4 for the Western Cape. Currently, we have got invoices and have cleared that with the CFO's office of 170 million. And just to close off, this is a school that is one of the schools that the Deputy Minister has already been part of the handover, and that this was its original state. And this is the aerial view of the completed school. And you'll see, now you'll get a better picture of the school itself in the DVD focused on the various stakeholders while showing us some pictures. But we go beyond just infrastructure. And you have the media minister who is the district director, Mr. Nuku, and they're on their walkabout, but in the background you can see the classrooms that have been completed. And this is in the classroom, a reading lesson, impromptu reading lesson. And the learners that have received this facility. At Willetta, which is opened by the minister, and ended over there, this was the original state. And this is the aerial view of the completed school. At the bottom, you can see the sanitation facility. The minister with the principal. Now, this is our grey art class. When we started off, you saw in the video a jungle gym. The jungle gym was never in our specs. There was a donation made when the president opened the school last year in October, and the day after, the minister requested that this become attended. But since then, we've actually gone on a tender now to acquire that gym to put into every school that we complete, which has a grey art facility. So this is a grey art facility, and it doesn't stop there. I didn't know that this was my job, that I must buy toys as well. So we also bought toys. I buy toys for my son, but I didn't know, he's only three, but I didn't know that now infrastructure also involves toys. So we provided, this is basically what you'll find in each of the schools. There's not much variation. What we give to one, we try to give to everyone. And these are the desks, right? If the school has furniture, we take them away. The durable is given to someone else, but we replace all the furniture in the school where we it's a new school. And the furniture is through a memorandum of agreement with the Department of Labor, and all the furniture has been supplied for these 49 schools through the Department of Labor. We're now looking at the Department of Environmental Affairs through the St. Parks, as well as Correctional Services, to build on beyond just in dealing with school furniture shortage across the country. And you can see that this is the types of desks that we have. We've got double combination. The issue to deal with chairs being found at your beams and so forth. So the safety issues of railings. And this is the children at the nutrition center just relaxing and playing. At Nobantu also, this is the terrain in which, in fact, in any other program, with some of the challenges that we have faced, we probably, as departments would have abandoned the program and then just given excuses for the wastage. But I think if we looked at the list again, we probably would have come to these schools last based on the difficulty in dealing with them. But this is the kind of area we are building schools in. So this is Nobantu in its completed form. The minister was the premier of the Eastern Cape. And here's the Great Art. This is the Great Art toilet. The toilet for the Great Art learners, just with the Great Art classroom in the background. Here you see this is a different school, but you've got a similar setup in providing that with a colorful tablecloth and chairs. And in this school, the children were already utilizing the facility even on the day of the handover. And together, in terms of providing ICT, the 25 laptops are given on it with the colleague to store there. You'll see that these children do not take, I've never seen these laptops or utilize these things before, but they don't take long to be able to catch up and utilize them. Even using the workbooks are being utilized electronically now. And we're considering looking at providing each child with a tablet instead of these, like, 25, and that probably the cost will be the same. We have the laboratories. When we started out, we're just building the laboratories, and now the 49 schools, we've also procured the science kits. In fact, even today now, even though we're infrastructure people, we have arranged a workshop to train the teachers on how to utilize those science kits. And we're basically going out on a tender to have... In libraries as well, we got donations to basically put books, but they have a framework agreement on to go out on tenders. We have a list of books available for us to stock up the library as well. So I think, Chair, that's our presentation. The colleagues are here to handle any of the, to answer any of the technical questions.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you very much for the presentation, and I'm so pleased to hear Ian saying that we're delivering us a new school every week. That's great. But you know, this committee has been sort of seized with the question of the 49 schools. Because originally we were told that these schools would be delivered in March 2011, all of them, all 49, because it was going to be open over the Christmas period. No.
2012, not
2011.
Well, we met them in 2011.
Okay, 2012, okay, sorry. And then nothing happened because, you know, they couldn't keep the supplies open over the Christmas period, and nobody built over the Christmas period. But then, then they were going to all be finished by end of August in 2012. Now, today, we see a year later, there's still 15 schools, or maybe 30%. More than 30%, but still not complete. Now, we are seized with the fact that, you know, we are providing money, but we are not seeing the output in time. My question is really, if you look at what we have at the moment, we're saying inside sixth year that we've spent virtually 90% of the approved contract sums on these 49 schools, but 30% of them are not yet complete. So are we going to finish up with spending more than the 69 million that we budgeted for or that we had contracts for? And if so, by how much? Because we also provided, we fired some contractors and we appointed new ones, so there could be a cost implication just in the length of period that's expired, as well as, you know, allocating new contracts. And I would very much like to know what those figures are. So that the committee can know, you know, we've given so much, but the actual expenditure is why. You know, we've given X, but it's actually why. And what is the other thing that's most disappointing, Chair, as far as I'm concerned, is that we've got implementing agents that are supposed to appoint just because they know what they're doing. But it's clear that they're not know. They don't know what they're doing. If with all due respect, I don't know whether the DBSA is here, I hope so, because they should hear, you know, the way in which they ran their programs and, you know, in completion for these schools was really not good. I don't know whether they're getting paid for it and how much they're getting paid and whether there's an overrun on that payment because they've been busy for a year longer than what they should have been, or more than a year longer. But I would also like to know, you know, what the financial implications are for us to have these implementing agents that are not performing.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I just want to understand that. I heard the minister was talking about the DM was talking about some of these, they realized at the last minute or later that these big companies that they say they've got progress, you know, they've got experience in terms of finishing in time. It's not what really, it's not the experience or the, because they've been there for a longer period than the smaller. So I want to understand, because they've realized that these SMEs are faster than the big companies, what is there now? Are they using the SMEs already on a resource, talking about taking long of all this thing and double the amount because they take long? But are they considering using them so that they can, you know, accelerate the other exercise the putting of or the completion of the school? My other issue is to say, as much as they are on, I would like to suggest that they must have a budget plan. So when I look at the slide number 7, it says expenditure based on the Department of Public Works. They spent already 43.7 million. Originally, how much was allocated? You know, I just see that expenditure, but you don't see how much was budgeted for. The other thing is about, they say, in terms of But I said by 2015, all the backlog will be finished. Are they on track? Because I can see 2015, we'll still be talking 49 schools, and they've been given extra 50 schools. You know, I'd like to understand exactly how is it going to happen to that. Because I can see these are the achievements, but it's not clear. I thought that they would say to us, from now on, because we've learned from our challenges, this is the way forward. And when they have that way forward, I would like to see the budget and the plan together. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Also, thanks to the Minister, the Department, for the presentation here this morning. I think the last 4 years we paid a lot of attention, especially to education and the infrastructure of building of schools. My question, only three questions this morning is, first of all, if the schools are open, are there enough teachers to teach children? Second thing is, if it's possible, they can provide us with a list of the last financial year's square meter costs per school in the different provinces, that would be appreciated. And then the third thing is, the schools are built, or they're in the process of building. Are there any maintenance programs in place, sustainable maintenance programs in place? The reason why I ask that is that are they making use of solar heating systems, solar panels? Because we experience in other departments a lot of problems. So I just want to find out what are the positions with water, with energy. Thank you, Chair.
I was covered by the Deputy Minister in his introduction of the input, more especially on the delivery of schools. In particular, when they refer to what is called the inappropriate schools, over above the schools that have been mentioned in the 2011-12 financial year and others. Because I also want to commend, in this case, the department around that particular area. Because in some instances, some of the things we actually see from time to time from where we come from. So to this chair, I was saying that maybe after 2014, one would be encouraged, if not making up, to go back to school. Because the kind of schools that now that we see there are really encouraging, even at the level of the operation, the teacher learner, you know, the kind of environment, it is encouraging. And as I'm encouraged to say this, because around this program of delivering a school per week, on the 5th of September, the school that I was the principal of is being is going to be delivered. After it's going to be a bit fortunate. I'm trying actually to say it's really one of the things that we are witnessing. And I'm making this reference because I'm encouraged, you know, to say the kind of a school that I taught even for 18 years being there, but now it is something else. That's what encourages me to say must commend the department as well. Over above the other witnesses that also are there. But there is progress that we are able to see. But also I want to check as much as UDM have spoken about this around the norms. I want to check in particular because of page or slide 12 is speaking up on the provision of mobile classrooms. My concern is that how do you, the department, respond or provide the mobile classrooms to the schools that is without lens? For example, the school was built long time ago, which is very much congested. I'll make this example. You have a big school, which accommodates plus minus 1,500 learners, with, of course, approximately 35, 36 educators. I'm bringing this case where you have the primary school starting from grade R, you have a grade R that is congested in one classroom. The following year, you will have your grade 1 that has 6 classrooms, you know. So there are some, there are those contradictions. The school is not able to respond to register grade R, all of them in the community, you know. So it would be first come, then they will be accommodated in that one class. But the following year, the school is able to attract 200 and something grade 1. And you know, some of the learners therefore will miss an opportunity of starting to that level. And I'm saying that because the challenges I have also learned and have experiences where the department will be able to say we'll provide mobile classrooms. And then they find that the limitation is the space. And how do you respond to those kind of situations where the school can't expand? Where you come in, you have resources in the department, but you can't do anything because of that kind of challenge. And the other one, lastly, as we appreciate these schools that have been upgraded and the new schools that are coming up, I also have a concern of saying, how as well do you do with this thing of teacher-learner ratio? How do you attract teachers in particular where we have learned from communities or from the systems of education as well, that there's a shortage of teachers in some other areas? I've also learned that there was something that was written, I can't remember where, which was also saying that teachers from other provinces where they are due to be in excess will also be moved to other provinces. So I just want to know, how are you going to deal with those kind of situations? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and the DM for your also intervention earlier on and the presentation that we have received. Thank you for that. I saw those movies earlier on, really nice pictures to make an impact and somebody to see that really quality of school has been built. So I think it's a nice thing. Those are nice pictures, a nice video. But let me come back to my question. DM, you know, I'm a bit worried, particularly around your earlier intervention on the Northern Standard. I'm worried that we have engaged with the department on the Northern Standard. I think back in 2011. Or even 2008. Now, what you have just presented, I didn't get that presentation at the time when we had the engagement about the problem that you picked up internally. When I talk internally, I'm talking politicians. When you refer to MECs, politicians who actually have put a spanner in a wheel, if you like, for X number of years. Today is 2013. This issue starts 2008. It drags on to 2030. I'm really taken aback by that.
that the seriousness and the will part in terms of making things happen has led for so long to a point of disintimidation or court processes because of failure of those who are entrusted with responsibility to do what they have to do. You know, with respect, DM, I think that if you look back into the situation, we're talking same government, not a different government, the same government. One government comes in, it says, this nonsense standard, we don't want it. We'll have to go back to the drawing board. Next year again, after the election, another government administration comes in, different set of MCs comes in, we go back to the drawing board again. The same issue of a nonsense standard. Because, you see, the answer is a concurrent function. But the issue policy is the responsibility of the Department of National Department of Education, which is nonsense standard is part of, in terms of saying, what is the quality of schools and how it has to lay that we want to see in the country. The issue of variables, about variables in terms of the computer, it's not what can solve the design issues, what type of school you want to design, and what does it look like, ratio, learner ratio issue, classroom ratio, and all other things. So, I'm pausing on this point to make my point that while I see nice pictures and I'm happy to see them, but I'm just taken aback about that statement that DM has made, because my memory serves me correctly. That statement was never made by the Department of Education to our committee. We kept raising this nonsense standard issue. And at some point the goals have shifted from nonsense standard to guidelines. Now I understand your explanation about how it moved from the nonsense standard to some guidelines, which it's too elastic for compliance, for your standard actually. Let me leave that aside, Chair, and to come back to the issue of the actual delivery. And I'm happy to hear that there's a school today. A week, sorry. Yeah, I don't know. Sorry. I'm breaking myself. So a week. Per month. Week. A week. So it's 4 schools a month. No. Don't interject that I'm asking. Mm-hmm. There is 4 schools a month. So agree with me. Four agree to agree with me, that here. So the question I'm looking at, on slide 5, there is on your presentation, there's 102 schools that were planned to be 2012-13. Now, and I'm not talking about the 49 yet. I'm talking about 102 schools. In terms of your project plan, your schedule of project plan, and your probably what you normally call milestone delivery in terms of that project plan, in terms if you put it on the board, if you have it here, and you just show us in terms of it, are you meeting 40% of it? Of 30% of that. And the adjustment that you're going to make, what does it cost in terms of resource and human? If you were to just show us in terms of that, so we can measure what you see, because I'm worried about when we're going to see the completion of what's supposed to have been done 12-13. Yeah. In terms of the progress has been quoted. 27 or 22 schools. And there's I see DBSA here, and I think you did mention their capacity. My understanding initially was that these agencies are brought in as acceleration, to accelerate the delivery. But contrary is probably correct. The opposite is correct. There isn't, if you look at what the DBSA is driving, is delivery. And we did have engagement with them at the time. and did indicate to them that what you are putting on the board, you're not going to achieve because of what you've already explained in terms of this. So, is there any other way that you can do to accelerate this process? Understanding what the DVSA you've given, sees the power to the DVSA in terms of the delivery of schools, your intervention in terms of contract may be limited in terms of that. What is it else that you can do to make sure that in terms of your work plan that you achieve the result? Because DM, I also want to understand the cost overall of that, because anything that you delay in terms of your work plan, including the prices fluctuate of when the petrol price goes up, the transport cost goes up, it affects you, and whether the budget that we have agreed initially is going to be able to meet the requirements. Associated with the budget is, when we talk about the ground and the problems of where the school is located, and then you come with an intern plan of a mobile school, I'm wondering where if you already have a land problem in the particular area, where you're going to situate the mobile school that you're talking about. What is the cost that's going to be into this? Is this an additional cost, or somebody who fails to deliver a school at a particular time, the cost of the mobile school is then appropriated to that particular agency? Or is this agency, is the Department of Education that is taking the cost? Who's going to bear the cost of this? Because if I understand you correctly, please correct me. I make mistakes because of the listening maybe problem. The what necessitates the intervention is a worry about delay, that we are not meeting our work plan. That's why the president intervened and said something else must be done. And spring into action to look at the mobile classroom. Is this as a result of the failure to meet the deadline by the agents themselves? 49 schools were supposed to have been completed. There's some challenges there, including the land, the layer of the land that necessitates the delay or shifting places. But the cost for additional, where is it going to come from? The point I'm really trying to find out from you is, are we going to later get some call for additional funding because of what is going to be received, called unforeseen expenses, because it may well fall within the unforeseen. It was not planned to have a mobile classroom. The material conditions during the year necessitated this. Where is the money going to come from? Then the slide number 10 worries me. I just want to ask this question. The price estimate in the actual tender price of the school. This estimate, is this the estimate from the Department of Education? Who, some of them is at 10 million apart. Does it mean that in terms of our cost estimation of the school, the quantities are saying our own pricing, our own calculation can be 10 million apart? How does that happen? Or do we deliberately plan it to be higher? Then you say you are within the range. I just want to understand it, because if you're doing the pricing, you calculate the price of a bridge. That's not the job of the quantity surveyor. And you calculate the number of pockets of cement and sand, then you get your price at the end of it, including the excavation and the concrete. That's how this works. At the end of the day, you then say, this is the price. Now, I want to know, 10 million is a lot of money to be out by. What is the method that do that estimate? If DM, you can maybe just help us to understand that, please. The sensor shows kind of movement of population, and it may have a consequential effect. The learner ratio also moves. Is the plan that we have started with still within that range of the or kind of learner ratio issue? Are we going to be able to mediate the two? Because it's also got to do with the planning issue. So I'm just asking, I know you didn't speak about that, and my apology for raising it. I know the Eastern Cape is the challenge of teachers. We always speak about it. And the last presentation, somebody we talked about, it increases the expenditure because of the teacher ratio and the contracting of teachers. The question I'm asking, concurrent planning of the construction of the school, and at the same time, the issue of the teacher ratio, availability of teachers in terms of it. The Eastern Cape has been having a number of challenges around the teacher and then study issues. So if you could just help me understand that. I have some, but I'll leave the others for my colleagues. Thank you.
Now, but if you just raise them here, sometimes you may not even understand.
Let me raise them, Chair, while you are giving the opportunity. Thank you very much for that. The slide that speaks to the water and sanitation, it shows that, again, I just want to ask the question, the kind of planning question, in terms of your own. Do you have the work schedule and kind of milestone that is, I'm asking the integratedness of that particular question. I mean, when we went to the Eastern Cape, there was also the chair speaks about the mayor of a particular town that will remain nameless at this point. That we come there as intruders and we don't understand what we do. Actually, that they are worried about those things and they are doing something about it. So just to understand the integration of the issue of water, because in some of the schools, there is water on the other side of the road, but the water is not in the school premises, and the electricity is the same. There's a cleaning bay, there is a lack of silo approach. So I want to understand, are we succeeding with a kind of intergovernmental approach in terms of addressing this in an integrated way? Is the plan being finalized? Do we have that kind of plan that shows each one that responsibility they're going to carry? I know COCTA also play a particular role in terms of that coordination. In fact, the last time we did ask the question from COCTA. The including the money, are you happy that the what we have in terms of the sanitation and electricity, in terms of this, and I know that you have made it really convincingly about the progress that's been made, we all agree. But the number that you have mentioned is 1,124. In terms of the water, the issue of access to water, what is the plan to be able to eat that number down? That's the question I'm asking.
Thank you, sir. I don't have a lot of questions. But Mr. Pagliari referred to, I heard him mention the Department of Correctional Services, and I wish he had expanded because we'll very soon be hearing that there were service providers, tenders are waiting for finishers and all the things. How far have they engaged the Department of Correctional Services as a form of rehabilitation in contributing towards the making of the furniture? I would just like to know that. And last time when we were in the Eastern Cape, I asked another question about, you remember when we were in that famous municipality, we had the doctor who's engaged by health. He told us about the tablet that can help very, very much as far as sanitation is concerned. I asked that question when we again the Eastern Cape, but Mr. Pagliari didn't respond to it. I would like to know if they once got in touch with Dr. Mangana, the engineer from who's who came there with the Department of Health. His surname is Saka, yeah, who referred to a certain tablet, which is very effective, because he also, when we were at that school and complaining about the sanitation there, he raised his hand and said there was a tablet that could, that's it, how. But it seems there was no follow-up done by the department. We would like to know how far they collaborate with other departments in as far as addressing the issues of accelerating the practice of school completion, like the assessment and the Department of Correctional Services, our FETs and all this, to contribute and save money in as far as the this school building programs are concerned, because they come as a package. And my concern still is DBSA. It seems it has a lot of schools, but I'm still looking at those schools as the Eastern Cape, which are still not completed, and DBSA is playing a big role there. Do they also use consultants, and who pays for those consultants? Because they should be having enough capacity and not get into the budget of the DBSA when they use their consultants.
Thank you very much. Maybe just if I can, from this. Did you hear something?
Okay. Thanks, Jefferson. For us to try to understand this thing, I mean, in terms of expenditure going forward in the MTF area, what's being delivered is a fantastic product. It's really heartening to see such wonderful facilities being developed and delivered in rural areas of the country. But we're going to have to sit down there and look at how these monies in the current form are appropriated. You have to start asking yourself, what went wrong at the initial scoping phase of the project? Because something went wrong. The department has been misinformed, in my opinion, by its consultant. I mean, the department itself wouldn't come up with a decision to be able to roll this out in a particular time frame, giving a political commitment to people on the ground what's going to take place if they didn't have information given to them by professionals that they hire. If you hire a team of consultants, you're going to have a consulting engineering component of that. One of those will be civil. Now, surely they know where the GPS coordinate is or where that site's going to be, and through that they need to be able to settle. The earthworks will have to take this length of time. Now, you can't... Your whole contract period is determined by the consultants based on the scope of work that has to be undertaken. So maybe there was something wrong. So what we need to try to do from the department is try and say, look, the initial scoping and the initial information that we're given has caused a delay of the X number of years. See, in the Eastern Cape, we're wanting to say that this financial year we'll do 824 million, and then 2014, 15, 2.16 billion, and then 2.9 billion. If I'm reading these figures correct, billion. It's impossible. Rather, let's try and adjust the MTF and roll this project out the way you want to roll it out and give that fantastic end product, but let us understand where it is actually going to end. Thank you.
Hi there.
Mm,
thank you very much, honorable members. And I think that Honorable Deputy Minister, I would just also like to touch on some of the, maybe to add on some of the questions that have been raised. You know, but starting with my, with the issue of the mobile classes, I want to make, to be a bit biased, you know, make an example about of a mobile school in my own constituency. Officials, I sent a report to the Department of Education and Housing, DDE, and it's destroyed. You know, unfortunately, I lost my phone, you know, a few days ago. I took pictures. You know, I don't know what is the situation of this mobile classes are supposed to be, but that particular school is in fact dilapidated, yeah, thank you, dilapidated, you know. It's a school on mobile classes, you know. One wonders, I mean, I'm raising this because sometimes it seems that the department is moving from the assumption that the things in Gauteng and the Western Cape are fast. In the Western Cape, I know of, no, there are not much schools in the Western Cape, but board or something, so you just push by what you call it. You know the schools, you can take it. It's a vessel. You know, it opens up and all those kinds of things. So there are challenges. I don't know if we've looked at those what you call the situations. Maybe the, I think the Western Cape are 14 schools. I don't know whether it's one of those schools. But in the, your former disadvantaged areas, you find those schools. A lot, you know. But that particular school in my area, I can give you the name and where the school is. You know, I went there on the 18th of July, this is what you call it. I went to clean the other school, you know. But at least the toilets, they're changing, they're in the process of changing the toilet. But the school itself, I mean, I didn't have those mobile classes. So the question that I'm trying to improvise is that one, mobile classes, maybe they are fine as a temporary what you call arrangement, but I guess that they should be there for a particular period. It's not a permanent, there cannot be a permanent what you call it, arrangement. You know, I wish one day we could go to that school. If you walk in the classroom, you know, and every day I say that there's no crisis that happens, that a child one day gets broken in that school. Inside the school, the floors, you know, we can see the ground there when I'm inside the school. It's a terrible what you call a situation, you know. I asked the question from the department, what is the plan about the school? They said, no, it's not on our priority list. That's what the department said to me. It said, it's not in the priority list, but I said, it's terrible, this thing that we find here. Now, I think maybe if we have mobile, what you call a classes, I think that there should be a clear time frame should be set. I think that the other thing, maybe we, in the last meeting and in this meeting, we asked that maybe now, I thought that we had understood at the beginning what were the challenges. Maybe we should move from the progress since we last met. For instance, the reason why members keep on raising this question, maybe it's also how we respond. It's not very clear. We say the program started in 2012, but that was the announcement, you know, and I remember the first meeting. It was on the 16th of November, 2011. When we had but that meeting didn't tell us, was not clear, didn't clarify us that took, what are the processes. So, department had came with the concept, now didn't tell us that now it was supposed now to go to service providers and make them understand and what is the process. But clearly, what DM is a problem is that this is how long it takes just to build one school. Let's take examples, for instance. The IDD got 12 schools in May 2012. Up to in May 2012. We are now in August 2015. How many schools have they completed? One school, no? Sorry? Yeah, I think there's no school. Then the same goes to CDC. 21 schools are now are on construction, and all of them. So I think that maybe what we need to do from your side, and I think that I made this request at the last time, is for you to take us through. Now you have what you call, this is where we are, this is how long this process is going to take to ensure that we get people on the ground. For instance, in 2011, I don't know if that's correct, but we were told that at the end of March there will be a school. But when there, in February, there was a, no, what you call it, at the site. But all of us, including the department itself, I don't know if Mr. Yala was there, but including the department itself, clearly we didn't understand how these processes work. We thought that if you make an announcement, then 4 months time, you can use the schools that you were showing this year. In 4 months, I don't know if you can do that. If you can deliver the schools in 4 months' time. So clearly, all of us, we didn't know what to call. But I think that it should never happen again. Because now, at the tip of our minds, we think that there was something wrong. But the issue is, GM, in this, I assume that we have, in order to explain this program, you have, the president has established the potential infrastructure, what you call it? PICC has established the PICC to try to accelerate the what you call it, the program. But in the Department of Education, is there a project management unit so that if IDT, CDC, all the service providers, they give you what you call it, they say to you, okay, now this is where we are. Can you sign off this thing? How long does it take within the department to sign off? Because I think that is a problem. I don't think that in the department there is an infrastructure to deal with this kind of what you call it. Even at this stage, it's not late. There's still a number of many schools that to be made. I think you need to do that so that there's no frustration from those service providers who say, no, in fact, we send our things to the department just to approve the documentation. So it takes over a month for the department to approve that. It should not be like that. So the reason is simple. You are expecting the DG. The DG has got is responsible for the rest of South Africa. Books are not delivered, there's a whole range of things that he's responsible for. But we want him also to be responsible for this infrastructure in the department when there's no infrastructure that is made in his office to deal with these things. We want him to do this sign off. I think that there's a problem there. We need to find a way of fast-tracking the process so that it does not what we call this application system. Because clearly there is a problem. If we were to say to these service providers, each one of them, tell us why from May last year up to now we have not delivered a single school. So, from May until now, we have not delivered a single school. And now we have some of these, what you call in some of the sites, there are contractors, in others, there are no contractors. We do understand that the issue the president was saying in the speech, that which we agree with him, that this issue has also assisted in terms of cartography, which was not initially taken into account. But we have learned those lessons. Unless in the department there is a unit that really focuses on this, I mean, this budget is supposed to be 8.2 billion over 3 years, but there's no unit that is responsible for this thing. So I think something needs to be done about that. We really want to, we have started now delivering on this, but let's accelerate. Now we have learned lessons, now let's accelerate. Honorable Ramshakana, you're talking about the the passport that we saw, which is a nice one. But it raises another question, you know. The question that it raises is that of the school transport system. You know, you see these children, they're walking these distances. So, I don't know, in the urban areas, they talk your 5 kilometers. But in the rural areas, they walk. They walk. You know, they walk a kilometer, you know, that 5 kilometers, it is worth here in Cape Town or anywhere else. But now, I think that also that's a question that it raises. But also, the Honorable Snell raises the question of the budget. You know, Honorable Snell is quite right. We need to sort out this issue of the budget now. We don't want to be confronted by this question when we come to budgeting as well. But how are we going to deal with this? Here that we have not been able to to reach our milestones within the, what you call it, the time, what you call it, effort. But now, how do we ensure that we roll out? Now, I think with the lessons that we have learned, can we be realistic now? What is achievable? What is the space of time? What is the budget that is wanted? Because now, I think that I see it in media right now. The department is giving a lot of money. It's not able to spend. Why? Why are they saying that? Everybody's saying that because of our calculations, you know. They say we're going to do this over this. We need this amount of money. Further gives amount of money. We have not looked at our capacity. Can we have brought this within the space of time? Now, it makes you become bad people, you know. Given the money, you can't use that money. So, I think our advice as a committee is that build what we call a capacity. So that if you come into to budget, you realize now, this year, 2013, the budget is 2.9. You want to a rollover of 1.3. I can tell you, I know the Minister of Finance, when he was tabling the budget, he said there must be a haircut. I think I'm the only one who's cut with hair. In terms of the budget, but on a bus we're going to do it. But clearly, it's not going to be a rollover that easily, you know. You have to do a lot of convincing. Because you can't give you can't spend 2.9 billion, you want 1.3 billion over and above that. Now, we are at the end of September, we'll be in 6 months' time. We have not spent, you were talking about 40% and 30%, we have not reached those targets. You see, on another DM, I think that we should be able to say what are we going to do so that our budget becomes a little bit realistic, you know. We don't want to, I mean, we also feel bad if the media, we see in the media there, we read right now. Department has not spent, is not spending this money that is being given. I think that is the my suggestion so far. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and to the honourable members for the contributions. I'm going to try to respond to the matters generally, and the acting DG and the team might look at these specific areas. And with the permission, with your permission, the permission of the committee itself, may I start with where you've ended? Because I think it's an important starting point. The point is this, that let us as a department become realistic. Let us assess where we are in terms of our performance. Let us assess exactly, precisely what we can achieve and what we can do and at what cost. And then plan accordingly. Let's not raise the expectations of the nation on the basis of the fact that we have set aside the millions of rand and the projection is the delivery of 251 schools only to discover at the end of the financial year that instead of the 251 pools, we have delivered only 150 and the others are in process of being built. I think that is what you are saying to us, that is what the Honourable Stella is saying to us, that is what the committee is saying to us, and I think it's realistic. The second point that you raised, Chairperson, and basically, let's put it this way, I've asked the Department of the Minister to say, look, when it comes to infrastructure, you know, let us become aware of the challenges so that we can communicate that to the nation, to Canada and to the nation in terms of precisely where we are and make the appropriate interventions and adjustments on the basis of information that is reliable and scientific that we know, you know, we can basically communicate through. The second point that you make is an important point, and I cannot, the acting DDG is here, he will verify what I'm saying. I've argued from the beginning with this infrastructure, with the STD project. I said, you know, how is it when educators whose core business is the curriculum and the implementation of the curriculum can believe that they suddenly have endowed with the extraordinary skills of being able to understand both the quantities, engineering design, penalties and contractual terms, you know, rights and obligations. It was unreasonable for us to expect that. The reality is now we've been given this particular task, we have to carry it out, but we do so in the belief that we ourselves, as educators, can do it, and we cannot. And unless and until we have a dedicated team to be able to do that, who can oversee this particular process, we are not going to succeed because the contractor is always going to be in a position of strength. The contractor would always know more about that particular terrain than you as an educator would know. And that basically creates the imbalance, and that is why you have a situation where you are not able to deliver on time. So what we've done as a result of that, basically taking your advice, we've established a dedicated team of engineers, quantity surveyors within the department, and then project managers to be able to oversee this particular process, and recognizing that there are limitations over here. And indeed, it has made a difference in terms of the delivery and in terms of the management of that particular process. So you, I can't differ or disagree with your views. I am saying that it certainly reinforces mine, and I think that's the advantage of coming over here, because at least I can tell the department it's not only my view. It emerges from other quarters as well and reliable quarters in terms of that particular process. Now, the third element, an important element, is this. And when I listen attentively to the contributions of the members, we should begin to understand how multidimensional, how complex, and how difficult the system of education is in its entirety. Not in terms of building the school, because if you talk about building the school, you can't talk about the infrastructure without water, without sanitation, without electricity. And when you talk about all those things, you can't talk about other areas of basically your teacher deployment within the particular school, the curriculum content itself, learner numbers, the teacher-learner ratio. So all these things fit together. You can't look at the one element without looking at the other dimension. So that makes it extremely difficult. And then you have to look at all that in the context of cooperative governance, where you have the national sphere, the provincial sphere, as well as in terms of your engagement with the municipal gentleman whom you shall remain nameless for purposes of this meeting out here, who has a particular responsibility in terms of delivery of service, but is unable or unwilling to do so and suggest that you don't seem to understand the education terrain. Now, I'm saying these are realities that we confront over there, and I'm glad that we're doing so. You have also, Chairperson, made the point, and I think it's a very critical point, the point of the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Council. And indeed, I would suggest that we look at what they are doing in terms of the CIP 13, if I'm not mistaken. It is CIP 13. And one of the reasons for CIP 13 is to really ensure that it basically has a handle on the different agents that are responsible for delivery. So take your electricity, for example. The main agent, the agent that we rely on is ESCOM. Now, for the department to drive ESCOM might be a bit difficult, but for the president to do so, it's much easier in terms of having this prioritization. Similarly with, as Mr. Mansakane correctly pointed out, you have a COSTA working with water, phase, and energy, you know, this tribe, so that they can have integration. But they could also work with the Department of Basic Education. And one of the reasons why the schools have been taken over is that it forms part of this particular SIP is to ensure that this integration takes place. The SIP itself is an integrated program, and I can only but be think the work they're doing is very, very commendable. I mean, I've engaged with their processes, and indeed they are working with the department in terms of that particular exercise. And I do believe, quite honestly do believe, that we're going to see great improvement. Now, if I could possibly also look at the other elements that you speak about, is the issues of migration, and while I reflect on what you're saying, it has also been raised in different contexts by other honorable members. So the issues of your mobile classes. One of the risks are if you install or establish provide mobile classrooms, you might find that it become a permanent feature unless they are monitored and unless there are a specific term and conditions which state that these are there for this particular duration. So that would be, if you don't do that, then that might become the reality of the lives of those learners for the next 10 years, where the intention was to basically provide a transition mechanism where you could have a more appropriate and safer structure provided to those learners. Over there, it's something that we have to be mindful of. So in terms of that particular process where we do provide, we might enter into an agreement in terms where we state categorically that these mobile classrooms would be utilized for this defined period, and it is linked then with the provision of the proper infrastructure. I'm grateful for it. Does it have, what about the cost implications? It's something that the department is looking at because we've already raised it. Both the minister and I raised the issues of cost because you might be too reckless in the terms of procuring the mobile classrooms and you realize that, my God, you know, it would cost less to build a school than providing mobile classrooms. What are the advantages? The advantages might well be that they are in the mobile classrooms, so when you don't require them, you are moving them to the other location. And given the reality of migration and migration within provinces and across provinces, mobile classrooms are going to be needed. And it's in this context that one could say that, you know, when we look at the discussions that took place on Gauteng and then the Western Cape, Gauteng is the greatest recipient of people from other provinces. We don't call them refugees, Mr. Ramatikane, but people from other provinces. And that's the reality. And when that happens, you have to provide accommodation and access to those learners immediately. You can't say that in six months' time or in 9 months' time we will establish a school year, thereafter you can bring your kids there. You've got to do so. And the reality is you might find overcrowded classrooms and you then have to utilize mobile classrooms. Now, in the context of the norms, this is one of the arguments that has been legitimately raised by both the Western Cape and by Gauteng. In the context of your norms, what do you do to accommodate? You have a competing interest of access and norms, optimal norms. Both MECs from both provinces will agree that we want to provide the best. But can they do it immediately? And now, if the norms are prescriptive and don't have the element of flexibility, it would simply mean that that particular learner or the stakeholders in that particular school can take the department to task for providing accommodation, even though it is temporary, because they don't comply with the norms, which are optimal. And that is why we say that in terms of drafting those norms, there must be a degree of flexibility that speaks to the context under which infrastructure is provided. So if you say that these classrooms, as you correctly pointed out, are a permanent feature, out, you can see the clause. But if they are a feature there for a defined period because of migration and circumstances beyond the control of that particular department, then one must recognize that reality. I think there was an expectation, and I don't think the department was at fault, and there was an expectation at that time that the norm would be adopted by all the MECs. What is the reality? The reality is if you look at your 9 MECs, they are all new. So all you have 9 new MECs from an administration who now basically enter into it, and Mr. Ramatlakane has been an MEC for himself, he would know that you basically have to come grips with the reality, look at the advice of your heads of department, and in fact, you have 9 new MECs and you have 9 new heads of departments. Now that is the nature of the change. So it's a new administration. So we cannot be surprised, we should not be surprised when basically different views are expressed. However, we said that notwithstanding that, at the very least, we should adopt these as guidelines. because we don't basically leave the matter lying loose and say we don't have any norms. And the reality is, and this is what I say, I always say, has any of the provinces built a structure that is below the minimum norm? No. So the guidelines were indeed utilized not only by the National Department, but also by provinces in the provision of infrastructure. Now the issue of basically prescribing that is underway, and I think it's something that we would basically find regulated by November, and let's leave it at that. But there are perspectives that we could not ignore. Because you can't on the one hand say that, okay, the National Department has the authority to do so. And then on the other hand argue that you can't do so arbitrarily without consulting with your NECs, because they are responsible. Technically, they are responsible for infrastructure. A city is merely an intervention to deal with a particular challenge of mud and unsafe schools and water and sanitation and electricity. It's not a norm that exists within the department. It's a norm because you still have your infrastructure grants, which provinces carry out on their own. So I just wanted to understand that particular thing. But we are not hostile towards or have an acrimonious relationship with Equal Education or any other organization. We do believe that they have a responsibility as a civic organization, and it's important that we have a conversation, and are grateful for the issue that they raise from time to time, only that they must be vigilant or be careful about how they provide the perspectives in terms of the challenges that we face. Now, the issue about one of the honorable members did indeed raise the matter, and we raised the same concern out there. You can't have a capacity within the department and then a capacity within DBSA or IDT and then outsourcing. Because that would mean basically you are spending three times, so kind of triple the fee. And we say that, look, if you develop sufficient capacity within the department, do you need IDT or DBSA? No. Because you have adequate capacity. And if you don't have that capacity there, and they get it out for you, they must be able to do so quite without having to outsource a particular skill over there. And we've already engaged with Minister Patel as well as Treasury in relation to this particular aspect to say, please let us monitor this particular element out here, because we don't want to be paying more than once for services that are legitimately rendered. Now, Mr. Ramadukane has basically raised some very, very interesting issues over here. I'm not going to deal with the norms and standards. I hope he understands the context out here, and I don't think it was intended to mislead anybody, but merely to reflect the history and the genesis of these norms and standards. But to tell you quite unequivocally that in terms of your minimum norms and standards, we are saying and we affirm and we will regulate provision of water, provision of electricity, provision of safe classrooms, provision of adequate sanitation is a norm that every single school must have, fencing and so forth. We're not going to argue, it's not contested, it will be in the norms and we will comply with that particular element over there. But, you know, democracy is such in the nature of conversations and discussions only enriches it. Because if we were to basically proceed without, right now, publishing the norm that we had published, or prescribing or regulating on the norms that we had published, that means that we are not paying sufficient attention to the inputs of stakeholders. And therefore, what do you do? How do you create a balance? You've got to basically apply your mind to what has been raised in that particular respect. Now, we be very cautious about ensuring that when we provide infrastructure, we do so in the context of a particular school. That's why your numbers become very, very important, your planning process becomes very important, and the provision of educators over there. We can share with you, Chairperson and the committee itself, that we are busy with the process of reviewing the food provisioning norm, not only in Eastern Cape, which has the biggest problem, but across the country, so that we have a uniform approach, so that skills begin to match the competencies required, and also that you have the deployment occurring in a much more efficient way. You know, right now, you have double pass teachers in the Eastern Cape, you have them in Limpopo and other provinces over there, and that contributes enormously to certainly reduces the ability of provinces to spend other elements, because your personnel cost goes up in places like Eastern Cape as close to 90%, which leaves very little space for other contributions. For the first time, you can say in the Eastern Cape, and there are some good stories, we've been able to reduce the provision norm, establishment, reduce it. We were taken to court, we succeeded in court. And the reason for it is there's been a decline in the number of limits in the Eastern Cape. because of migration and other factors. Obviously, it was resistance. Well, it's not only, they've gone to KwaZulu-Natal, they've gone to the Western Cape, they've gone to Gauteng, other else, because of economic opportunity, people seek work, and that's the reality of life. People are going to go from the rural to the urban. And even Cape is more rural, and Limpopo is more rural, and you would have that migration from these provinces to the cities and to other provinces where opportunities are created. So yes, Gauteng would become an obvious magnet for people, and the Western Cape too in the context of where you are located within the Eastern Cape. But that there has met with a lot of resistance. So it's really basically navigating through a process where we can develop a model in consultation with the union, so that we can say, look, you know, we still review it now. This is a more efficient and appropriate model, and this process is underway involving all of the nine provinces, and I do believe that could help us tremendously. And then there was the issue of solar panels that was raised. You know, we tend to cut ourselves down. Solar panels are featured in our schools. Am I right? Solar panels in some of our schools. They're mostly on the grid itself. But as a country, by March this year, we would be providing 5 million, yes, 5 million solar panels to people who have had no access for housing alone. So basically, we encourage it wherever possible in our schools for that particular purposes. But I think our challenge in our rural area is not hot and cold water, it's really water for a start, you know. And therefore, solar panels would feature so prominently in the context of where we are. But wherever appropriate, they will be utilized. But we've got the green of our schools, and that's where the acting DG spoke about the innovative methodology, which is green, which is environmental friendly, would be basically the norm for the other 100 schools that are 100 or that at the moment that are being developed over here. So Chair, I thought I dealt broadly with the issues, but this, you know, here's a wonderful example from the honourable member who's seated next to me with regard to Great R. You know, 6 years ago, we had less than 400,000. We had about 360,000 learners in grade R in our schools. Today, we have more than 750,000. Now, it's more than double. Today, and the reality is, according to Statistics South Africa, today, 92.5% of all our children have had at least 1 year of grade R learning, which means that those who are not in our schools are in community inclusion. And ideally, they should be in school so that we have this uniform curriculum that's provided and this uniform training. But that demand itself is so extraordinary, it means you could have a special design classroom. You saw it in the picture, and where as the acting DG showed you, your grade 1 and your grade R classrooms are different. The nature of your activity in a grade R class is through play. It's less formal than in a grade 1. That's why you need the jungle gym next to the classroom over there, because that's the nature of the activity, development of fine motor skills, social interaction, and a range of things. Even the charts, even the colors play a particular role in the environment. Now that creates a huge pressure on schools to be able to provide the appropriate conducive environment just for the grade R. Now what have we done? We've basically said, look, with regard to the grade R, we've set out norms. Very, very interesting. We set out norms for a grade R class, and I must say that most of the provinces are combined with that norm. It's not regulated, it's not prescribed, it's a guideline. But you would find that the design of a grade R classroom is built conforms with that guideline, which is what we regard as a norm. And it also says that in terms of that norm, also provides this particular facility. There are challenges in some instances, and the challenges of land become a reality. It depends whether you're in an urban or a rural setting, whether there's land available. Can you provide a jungle gym? And if you can't provide, how do you find creative ways of play for those particular children? And if you can increase the number of grade R classes to 2 or 3, do you have sufficient space in your learning environment for that particular reality? Now, these are complex, very, very complex stuff. But at the end of the day, that's why I say it is so multidimensional. No question is going to be asked about length, about norms, about resource. They're going to say, why is this child being denied access to attend a grade R class in your school?
It's not our problem, it's yours. Solve it. We can't tell them, but you know, our grade 2s and our grade 3s don't even advance. They said the right of education and early childhood development is central to your own plans and the plans in terms of the NDP. How do you respond to that? Some say that, no, so have some understanding of the huge challenge that we face there, and we're trying to basically plan better. At the end of the day, it comes to what the Honourable Member, Honourable Snell, has said. It means better planning. It means an honest reflection and assessment of what you can do and what you cannot do. If we don't do that, then we're going to fool ourselves, and we're going to embarrass ourselves, and we're going to create illegitimate expectations in the nation. Let me conclude by just raising this deviation in terms of what our queue is. So that's a good reality. You see, when I looked at the deviations, I also looked at them and said, now why would one QS make a calculation at X amount? And there's a deviation of 10 to 15% in general in terms of the amounts that have been quantified. We saw it in the Eastern Cape. Seasoned, experienced contractors had undercalculated. And the question that what they tried to do, the patriarchy will tell you, is to say, if you give us more money, we will, and waive your penalties, we will give you your schools by the end of the year. You have two things to do. One is to waive your penalties, and the number two is to give them more money, because they had undercalculated the cost. They did not look at the topography that you spoke about, Chair, as well as the other services, the access to the place and so forth. Some contractors don't realize that if you've got to go to the rural area, if you go to the Sikkim Libode, just to deliver cement to that destination will cost you twice the amount of a delivery for the same distance to Gauteng. And how much longer you've got to wait. They make these errors in calculation. Now, I don't know. I think the department has been more cautious in terms of really calculating, from a QS perspective, what it would be. But contractors calculate. Some of them go and do inspection on-site. Others provide it to QS to say, do the calculations, and they do so mechanically. Punch the numbers into a computer. It throws out the numbers over there. They add the labor costs, and that's the calculation. Only to discover when they get to the site, my God, we've made a mistake. That might be an explanation for the deviation. The other explanation might well be that there's been an error in terms of, or certainly in terms of the judgment. I don't know, you know, because costs are derived from your earthworks, from your steel within the structure itself. So I don't think there's a quality surveyor. If you put three quantity surveyors in the room and tell them to quantify the value of the work in terms of material, I can guarantee you're going to get three different answers. It is always going to be a deviation. And therefore, there has to be a ballpark of between 10 to 15%. I practiced law for a long time, so I know that. So that's one of the realities that could contribute to it. But when there's a deviation of about 10 million, in terms of a project, then you need to look at it closely. And I would ask the department to look at that and try to find out why the deviation in those instances are so huge. Because there should be an explanation. It's unusual. You know, deviation of about 20% is something that you have to look at more closely. An interesting thing occurred, and, you know, and I think we've learned a few lessons. In the Eastern Cape, because when you believe, you know, that you have a client that is reliable and has a reputation, you enter into an agreement, you give them 12 schools, and you believe that they would deliver on those 12 schools. Only to discover that they are delivering on 8 of the 12 schools, and the 4 hard-to-do schools are not being delivered. Now, if you want to cancel, you've got to cancel the entire contract. And one of the lessons that we've learned out of that, well, DBS has listened to me, you cannot have one contract for 12 schools. You've got to have a contract per school. So you need to determine the contract. You determine a contract on the basis of non-performance of that particular school. And you know, what they then do is they utilize those 12 schools as a means of blackmailing the department to say, if we don't get an extension, if we don't get more money, then all 12 schools will be delivered. The choice that we had to make is basically do we waive the penalties and pay extra, or tell them to get stuff, and we told them to get stuff. We did not waive the penalties, so it's not costing us more. At least that money has been retained over there, and we were able to do what we are doing right now. If we had completed it, it would have been done at the expense of the taxpayer. It would have meant waiving the penalties.
And I think these are the principal issues that we look at. But if we don't manage, oversee, and oversee our project well enough through competent people, as you say, chairperson, and other honorable members, we can run into trouble. And therefore, it's just critical that we have the appropriate capacity to do so and to recognize that, after all, even as ministers and as chairpersons of committees, we are not quantity surveyors or architects or engineers. We have a broad, ripple understanding, but we don't have a deep understanding, and therefore require two people to do the task. That, in fact, is the view that we've taken as a ministry. That is what we've conveyed to our acting DG, as well as the former, as well as the DG, as well as our engineering team today. Let's not mess around with it, because we're not talking about a few million rands. We're talking about a lot of money to which we are comfortable. So we hope that it's going to get better. I would suggest, Chairperson, as a way forward, is that we receive a report to say, on the basis of this projection of yours in relation to progress, can you tell us honestly, provide us with an assessment of whether indeed you think you've met your target and where you think the constraints are going to be, and be honest with the committee in terms of that. Because we want that honesty. It doesn't help to conceal challenges. We'd rather share them with you so that there's an understanding of it, and then we can make the appropriate arrangements in terms of, say, what do we do differently over here? We are together in it. And if indeed, IDT, assuming IDT is to build in the Free State and is to build in the Eastern Cape, is able to build in the Free State and is unable to build in the Free State, why don't we just tell them, finish your job in the Free State, we will take the Eastern Cape away from you because you don't have the capacity and give it to somebody else. Those choices can be made, and that would have to be done on the basis of a proper assessment. So I don't know if the DG would like to add anything or any other members. I'm sorry for being so long, but I tried to respond to the issues that have been raised.
No, I think we have answered the question. So there could be additions that you might want to add. Sorry, Acting PC, you wanted to...
Yes, I thought that you would have entered the combat zone when an attribution is made about the sense of question. I've never made the point or alluded to the point of people who come to the Western Cape and characterize them as a refugee. So I thought that from where you're sitting, you would have entered the combat zone.
Refer to you because they know that you didn't. You can't make that. You see now you're opening a can of worms. Now it was a joke on other sort.
I just want to say to you that I'm very concerned about Honourable from DZ saying that she wants to go back to school, but in the meantime she's got to marry me. So I don't know what.
We'll negotiate that.
Okay, I just want to thank you to the Minister, Deputy Minister, for the reply, but as a way forward, and if we could also have, you know, the breakdown of the schools actually by school virtually, and how we are in terms of progress of that school, and is there any financial overrun that we've got to look at?
Chairperson, I'm not certain, but my questions are not answered. I think it's on the way. I was not here, perhaps they answered it, but I just want to find out.
I think the question that Honorable Khadrom raised was the cost per, what you call it, per square meter.
Yeah.
And I would like to hear from the, what you call it, the department. But I think that we have raised this question, you know, for me, I would like us to check whether, unless we feel that, because I think the response that we have got in the past was that of different, what we call schools, in terms of different topographies that exist. So, I don't know, perhaps you might want to respond to this question.
Based on the order for for me important is the maintenance contract. And restrict these, are there enough teachers for schools that open? I just want to find out that.
To be sure, the GM might come back to the question of the teacher, but I thought that there was a response for that. You want to add, Mr. Padash?
I think, Honorable Chair, some of the questions were in the suggestion of the Deputy Minister will provide, like per meter cost. But because we are doing some work, not just for the CD, but for the DICC to look at costs. Per meter cost across, even outside the city. So we could, in providing that report, we could give you also that information. And one of the things that we found is that in terms of, the only two things that we did not do when we opened these schools. We did not provide textbooks. In fact, the reason we did not, because we found that these schools had the textbooks and the workbooks. And the other is that we did not have to kidnap someone from somewhere to become a teacher. That's the last thing I have to do. But I think one of the good things that has happened is that, in like, for example, many of the schools are multi-grade schools, but when you, they have used a grade one and a grade R teacher being the same person, but because of a building like providing the grade R facility, we've actually had the school now having its own additional educator. So some of these schools, because of their new infrastructure, actually were able to get their full complement. But I think the issue of getting young graduates to go to the remote areas is still an issue because I think in, not so much in like in KZN, we have to look at teacher accommodation as something that we'll need to address.
Okay.
Any addition? Happy? Summer Twins? You don't want to end your ticket? Honorable
I was interested in them utilizing the rehabilitation programs in some of those grade finishers and all the stuff, whether they have thought of doing that. That's just what I wanted to know from.
Chairperson, thank you very much for that. In fact, I was going to give you a comprehensive answer. It's very, very interesting. We the agencies that we have correctional services, we have the Department of Labor, we have FET colleges. The FET colleges are utilized primarily by the provinces for reconditioning furniture that requires repair, because otherwise it's wasteful to really replace it when it just requires certain repairs, and many provinces are doing that. The National Department, because of the dire demand for furniture, not only in the new schools, but also in areas like in Popo and in the Eastern Cape, have approached labor, correctional services, and also environmental affairs, because they cut off the non-indigenous plants, the trees, and utilize that plant to make school furniture, very, very strong furniture over there. So it does two things, basically, the removal of non-indigenous plants, which basically take a lot of water, and utilizing that particular resource to make furniture. We in fact, Mr. Padiachi is responsible for that, to engage with them over there, and we have already produced and delivered furniture. In fact, there's about 7,000 units. We're looking at 70,000 from environmental affairs. Our view and our intention is basically to ensure that every child has a seat. You can't accept a child sitting on a till or on a lock. I mean, that basically, and that's why we're having this multi-pronged approach, and we're utilizing resources within government and within the department to be able to do that in support of other alternatives. So in other words, provinces can still procure from other sources, but the FET colleges are indeed being utilized, ma'am. Now that I can assure you.
Okay.
You're fine with the decision. I on the lighter side, there used to be a program called the Mind Your Language. You mustn't forget that program, Mind Your Language, you know. Sometimes it was hijacking teachers.
it might be misinterpreted, you know. But I think that, DM, I think we're trying to wind up. I don't know if there are any additions and closings that you would like to make. And, yeah, I know I can feel busy. I'm saying, I don't know if you want to make air from your side.
Chairperson, on behalf of the entire delegation, to really say thank you to you and to the on the members of the committee. You might think that the difficult questions are not welcome. I think they are necessary, because what they do is really draw our attention to certain important elements that we have to look into. As indicated by the honourable members, we're not talking about a small infrastructure spend. You've mentioned that as well. We're talking about things that go into millions of rand, and we can't be irresponsible in terms of how we manage the process. So we really thank you for that opportunity and say, well, I hope we have, in a way, responded appropriately or adequately to your concerns. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, CM and the team. I think that from our side, as a committee, we appreciate this engagement, but also we appreciate your frankness in terms of responding to challenges, because we think that we are together in this. If you don't succeed, people will not say that it's not that the Department of Education, it's government that has not has failed to deliver. So that's why it is important for us to ensure that we together the resources that have been given, at least especially in these economic times where the budget is really so tight, that we could really try to be efficient and effective economical as well in terms of the usage of the resources. We also appreciate the fact that you don't want to create a resource. I mean, you don't want to create a construction department in the Department of Education that you may not need the what to call it. But I think that it's important to, and I think that Ms. Diale and her team, I think they have really, they have not appreciated enough the work that they are doing. But I think that together, and we are happy that from yourself, you can appreciate that it can take 12 months just to appoint the professional. Something somewhere in the system is not right. And I think that, we appreciate that you also understand that maybe what the team needs to do is to say exactly how much time do the professionals need to do this work in this number of schools once they are appointed? How much time does it take to appoint them? How much time does it take for the professionals to do the work and for them to appoint the contractors? So that we can appreciate exactly how many schools can be built within a particular period of time. But also maybe we should kind of improve in the language that we're using here. We're talking about here, I'm just going to make an example of something that is not very clear. The Department of Public Works, where did I see it? It says that, 10 schools have been handed over. I'm sure if you ask one of us to interpret this handover, it means that the key has been handed over, but also it says the handover to the conductors, in this language. So I think clarity is important so that we don't go out here and say that public web has handed over 10 schools within 10 months. Why is student A or CBC or IDT struggling to do this thing? And you come back and say, no, we didn't mean that. I think that it's important just to use language that will be understandable to all of us. But we will want to call it continue to engage, especially around the budget, so that at the end of the day we must be able to support your budget, because we understand. Just at the end, the last thing is to say a lot of progress has been made. We might not be able to appreciate it, but a lot of progress has been made. But it's clear that with your, I know that you are part of the CICC, we must check up our work. You know, we must check up. Oh, the last thing. So, we appreciate that you have communication. Please, don't make yourself in future. What is the word? We don't see you there. You know, communicating and about your achievement. You know, and people, if you don't communicate, people take what they hear that you're doing nothing. For instance, it's only the dead work that it's only that or people they hear this opinion, whether they are wrong or right, because nobody is saying anything different. And those people, the capacity, they go to SAPC, they go to where, and unfortunately, the visual communication is very powerful. They show a school that the department is doing nothing. The committee knows. I know. The Committee of Education knows that a lot of work, a lot of money, something is being done. But the Department of Education, it's like powerless, sitting there working, not able to respond. No. I think that something needs to be done. I think that something really needs to be done. The name is Mr. Who? Yeah, whoever. I think that would be no, I couldn't hear it, but Gumbo. Oh, okay, Mr. Gumbo. Hello. Maybe. On this note, I would really like to thank you, Tim, for your time and everyone else. And the meter, so you are free to stay with us. You're welcome today, you have time. You can. No, thank you very much. You are excused. That announcement from outside. Excuse me. No, quickly. Honest members, I think there is a draft. I'm going to have to do just one thing now. We have a quorum. You know, we passed the minutes up to end of March. But the copy of the minutes where we had the department somehow was not adopted. And the meeting that we had with them was in February. Was in the 20th of February. So I don't know how come that we passed the adopted the minutes up to the end of March. And this particular minutes were not adopted. Maybe what we could do, because
honored members have missed the coffees. In the next meeting, we bring a coffee so that we can adopt it.
Well, when is the next meeting?
Tomorrow, okay, we are seeing the performance monitoring and evaluation.
Okay.
Thank you very much. So, Sotoko? No, that was adopted. Which one is that? Oh, the follow-up. Yeah, but I think at the next meeting we must talk about that because we have also looked at how much we have, what can we do about that. Okay. No, thank you very much.